My topic in this session deals with the book of 1 Kings. And along with that review is to make spiritual applications of things. And so often you hear individuals in congregations who do not want to look at things in the Old Testament because there is an assumption, for whatever reason it may be, that there can't be spiritual applications to a Christian life. And yet, I think there's quite a bit of contrary information. When the book of 1 Kings opens up, we have David nearing the end of his time frame. And this book is going to cover, depending on how you number things. And remember, there's differing ways to number, we don't know exactly year spans. So, in an approximation, we're looking at about a 118-year period in which the book of 1 Kings covers. That doesn't mean anything to you. To put it into a different perspective, our second president was leaving office in about 1800. About 118 years later, does anybody know who was president then? Woodrow Wilson. And there was a lot of things that happened in that short 118-year span. We had not only did we have those numbers of presidents from the 28th president, second president, so 26 presidents, unless you... Yes, I understand Grover Cleveland was twice numbered in there. But we also have to include in this land Jefferson Davis, don't we? Because we had a nation that was divided. Well, we're going to number all these kings from a divided nation. There's parallels here. In our nation, we had a civil war, and we're going to find a civil war that's going to come up in the nation of God's children. And whereas ours was resolved in a relatively short period, unfortunately, theirs wasn't by their own devices. Now, it is interesting that their civil war was ended by devices that were outside of their own powers. We have to have a period when they are removed from their land, in part to cleanse it from this turmoil that begins, and we see it happening here in the book of 1 Kings. David is the king. And the book opens up with him being old and stricken in years. And yet, while death seems to be imminent, it doesn't happen right away, does it? There's quite a few things that are going to happen before he dies. And we want to look at this, dividing it out in certain ways. Because there are certain key events that happen in this book that have great impact upon the nation that God has chosen to be the receivers of his oracles, and of course to be that nation that brings forth the Son of God. But David is of that house and lineage that is going to be producing the Son of God. It's been alluded to several times. Let's go back to the 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, dealing with the first ascension of the king. And the nation was being ruled by a very capable individual as far as an administrative standpoint goes. His sons, however, weren't of like mind. And the nation quickly realized that, and they wanted a change to happen. Now, change for change's sake seldom is very good. Change for a good purpose many times produces good results. So I guess the question here is they wanted a king, and we might say, well, they had a reasonable purpose in mind, or it was available to them. Because I don't think there's any way to dispute the fact that Samuel's sons just weren't capable of leading. They were doing wrong. Samuel was the judge because his predecessor's sons had not done rightly. And the pattern has change. Now, if the people had said, your sons are evil, and we want to change, that might be something that was worthwhile. But why did they want a king? Be like everybody else. That was one. The second thing was that the king would lead them in battle. And this is always a humorous thing when we find the nation of Israel is at battle. And where was David? He was back home. He was enjoying life. Let us have a king so that we can be like others and lead us into battle. Didn't quite work out so well, did it? Now the warning came that, okay, if you want a king, here's what the king is going to do. And it takes a while for this to come to fruition. And really, in the book of 1 Kings, we start to see some of this actually happening. Because some of the warning dealt with what the king was going to do to your sons and to your daughters. And Solomon brings a lot of that to fruition. So, that's the setup. This wasn't necessarily what God had designated as his initial plan, but as so often happens, God makes do with that situation. And so in 1 Kings, we open up with that great King David, who has been anointed from a young age to be the king, and as we've seen through the descriptions in Psalms, sometimes it was a terrible struggle for him to be able to achieve the situation where he is the reigning king. Now, David seldom ever had peace. He had wars constantly, but some of the greatest and hardest battles had to be in his own home front. As a parent, what do you think of his parenting skills? Is he your model? This guy had more troubles than a soap opera. In fact, when you look at the intrigues of these and what I see on the tabloids and the grocery stores, that soap opera digest or something, it almost looks like somebody's been reading David's life and put him into the screenplays, because he has all of those elements that we think are of this time frame. People never change. And that's the timelessness of this book and why this Older Testament is very, very important to us. So when this begins to open up, there seems to be an unrelated situation where David has somebody attending to him. And that's going to come up later on. One of those little key things when you study the Bible and look and you see and what seems to be a filler. We know what fillers are in the paper where you don't have an advertisement to sell and you don't have an article big enough and you find something to stick in there. And in the third verse, we have this damsel who is there to help the king in his age, and a name is tossed out there, and you ask, well, why? Well, later on it becomes obvious. Because it's one of those things that further the intrigue that's set up in this. And the great crisis is not necessarily David's health, but the great crisis is, of course, problems with his children. Crop up all the time with David. Adonijah, one of his sons, has decided that the time has come for himself to be the king. Now, David had, in fact, made it known who was going to be his successor. Do we agree with that? That he made it known. Pardon? He promised Bathsheba, but who else was aware of this whole thing? Obviously Solomon was, but who else was aware of this? Nathan had this information, which tells us then that it wasn't a private communication that only a man and his wife may exchange, but it was something that was known out into a more public setting. Nathan, of course, being the prophet of the nation at the time, and that would mean that it was a very public item. Adonijah, And my little booklet says, usurps the throne of David. Oh, that's right. I want to give you these outlines, take one of each, and they're bare bones, and I mean this is really bare bones, and it's two people's approach to it. And so what you're going to find is this first 11 chapters really deal with Solomon and David, transition of power, and it was a struggle. It's always a wonderful thing when the government can pass peacefully. And this nation, at this point, hasn't had that. The passage of one ruler to the next, Saul to David, was not a peaceful ordeal. It cost the nation great in blood and untold amounts of separation between tribes, families. And unfortunately, when David has done so much to establish peace outside the borders, that peace can't remain here. So we have Adonijah trying to usurp David's throne. And he really was. The family was well aware of who the situation was going to be. And much in the same fashion as Absalom had previously done, he tried a publicity move. I hate to be crass about this in a political sense, but that's what he did. He was a politician, and he went about doing those kingly presidential things to be able to gain the support of the people and therefore overpower what his father had already planned. And that's an important thing for us to give consideration to. What spiritual applications can you apply to that event that Adonijah is engaged in our Christian world, especially as it relates to leadership, say, within not only our nation, but our churches, our congregations? Everybody catch that? Respect the authority. Now, this is on several layers, isn't it? Number one, Adonijah did not have respect for the authority of his own father. Number two, he did not have respect for the authority of the plan that was set up by his father. Remember, he's trying to take the kingship before the king is dead. Now, I suppose you could say, well, he was respecting him enough that he didn't walk in and slit his throat. But let's not put brownie points for Adonijah on this. He was wrong. David's attitude towards authority is remarkable. When he received the news of the death of Saul and Jonathan, and the teller of this news confesses to the fact that they were going to die anyway, and I went ahead and killed them. David, of course, raised the question, why didn't you fear God's anointed? So, for Adonijah to not respect either the kingship of his father or his father's plan goes against the whole core of what David stood for. And so this was a great thing. We need to always have that respect for those, not only in our civil governments, but also especially for those who are willing to stick by the plan, and in this case, the plan that God has set. This becomes very important. We say, well, we don't have to worry about that in congregations of Christ, because we don't really see anybody that would be usurping the plan that God has set forth. Well, is that the case? Sadly, it's not. Because there are many who come forth with all sorts of new plans and new ideas, like Absalom and like Adam, come to regard as being presidential or elderly, and win the hearts of the people, and therefore reduce resistance to this. It didn't quite work. Now, one of the things that happens in this situation is that we have a breakdown of the inner core of David's political offices. We have his inner circle would be Zadok and Abiathar and Joab. Now, one might argue, no matter how brave Joab had been towards many things, how loyal, truthfully, was Joab to David? We have a very... Does anybody want to disagree with that? I do that a lot, Thomas. Don't feel... Okay. He betrayed David in regards to Absalom, didn't he? Could be. But he betrayed him. He flat murdered Abner. Again, in a betrayal. Well, the kingdom's good. You know? And that's an important thing, isn't it? Because there's a lot of times that people will say, well, the greater good is worth the crime that brought it about. We have the defection of Abiathar. Normally, when we list things or people, we do it alphabetically, don't we? And those of you who, Tom Woody, was always last in his class. Unless he could have got somebody. Steve Zepp can move into his school. But there's an oddity here when we find Abiathar and Zadok, the priest list. Have you seen how that's listed in Kings, 1 Kings? Every single time two are listed together, it's Zadok and Abiathar. Exactly opposite of our more normal mentality of A to Z. But there's something further. Abiathar is also the older of the two. And yet, in every instance, in the recording of these, it's Zadok and Abiathar. And it may well be because of this very betrayal. Now, Abiathar has high credentials, doesn't he? We've already reviewed how he was the one who was a stalwart to David in his time that he was on the run. But his inner circle breaks down over the son who broke away from David's plan. It took then Bathsheba, Nathan coming, and the whole situation was Nathan or David standing up. Now, have you ever put yourself, in the position of David in this situation? How generally did he deal with difficulties with his children? Didn't do anything. When his son raped Tamar, what did he do? When his son murdered his son, what did he do? Nothing. Mild exile. And then brought him back, didn't he? And when his son committed rebellion against him, in stealing the hearts of the people, what did he do? Well, yeah, don't hurt him. Don't hurt him. So for David to be in this situation when he finally stands up at Adonijah, it is an amazing thing. It may be one of the strongest moments in his life when he's at physically his weakest. That he's there. I think there's something for us in that. That when we are at our height of our power, our glory, in this world, maybe that's not the time we're the strongest. Maybe it's when we are getting into another level that we have to seek out something else. And David finally stands because his kingdom really depends upon. And so Solomon rises into the kingship. And here's one of those humorous things. How was Solomon proclaimed as king? What procession, what Lincoln, what Cadillac did he ride? A mule. A mule. Now, is there something ironic in the fact that there's a mule utilized in this? Some would say that. Some would say that. What did God have to say about mules? How are mules made? Two different animals, a crossbreeding of animals. A mule is then, in essence, man taking over a creative process of God. And it's setting aside perhaps this whole purity that God has put forth. And here comes Solomon, who, yes, is the rightful successor upon this animal that is coming or bearing him into that throne. Now, we're going to have to go quickly on this. So we give into the second chapter, and David gives instructions to Solomon. Is there anything unusual? Let's review these things. David tells him that there are certain things that Solomon is going to have to do. Basically, Solomon's going to have to kill a whole bunch of people to come into office. Now, he basically says, for the protection of this, of your kingship and the kingdom itself, you need to do these things. He doesn't necessarily make it a command to do that. And Solomon sees the wisdom of all this, and he complies. But what's most unusual about each of these individuals that he tells Solomon he's going to have to deal with? By David. Once again, David has those that were closest to David. He really had difficulty dealing with them in an upright fashion. Each one of these individuals, yes, he should have been the one to have dealt with it. And he didn't. Now, do you find something that's really interesting in his character? Because he was not permitted to build the temple. And his own voice says why God told it in 1 Chronicles, the 28th chapter, and I think what, 5th verse. Is where he, the opening, oh yeah, second verse, I had my heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of the Lord, for the footstool of our God, and made ready the building. But God said to me, thou shalt not build a house for my name, because thou hast been a man of war and hast shed blood. Now, isn't there something that's ironic that this man who is not permitted to build it because of the wars seemingly had a great difficulty in being able to execute the office of a king when there were crimes committed that were worthy of execution? Everybody hear that? The patience, really, of David. The long-suffering of David. Many times, our reaction is pretty swift. Paul's judgment of the value of John Mark was real swift. He's no value to me, and Barnabas could see something beyond. And the patience of Barnabas then eventually made Paul say, bring him to me, he's of value to me. God calls David a man after his own heart. And God is long-suffering to us, not willing that any should perish. And so gratefully, we have what seems to be, in a physical sense, a worldly sense, David has a weakness here that just seems to be inexcusable. And yet, the sad part of it is, the execution eventually has to come. Joab really is, and he was a very worldly man, if you want to look at it. He was the pragmatic man. Every politician has to have Joab. Absolutely has to. Lonnie talking about how can a Christian get elected. Well, it may not be simple on a greater level. The higher you get into our nation's politics and the state politics, very honestly, yes, you do find compromises have been made. And yes, a Christian can turn their eyes to those things and pretend they don't happen, but they do. I can testify to that. I can testify to that. And I don't think Indiana's isolated. In fact, what I've seen of other states, some of those people are really good. Really good. And I won't tell you some of the things I've done politically. So, let it rest. But David needed Joab. Solomon didn't. Why didn't Solomon need it? Why do you think Solomon didn't need it? He did not conquer by himself. In fact, he didn't need to go out. The borders had been expanded from the Euphrates to the river of Egypt. The borders had been secured from the east and the west. And so often, as is the case in those kind of circumstances, great advancement happens politically. Politically, we're going to find out that Solomon had a great time of influence. Bathsheba came. People were wanting to know of his greatness. we find that trade went out way beyond the borders of Israel. But there's a couple of things that are really striking in the kingdom of Solomon, especially as it begins in the third chapter. What event happens here in the opening of it? Strange woman. Now, do you think that it's by accident where he got this wife? He went right back to Egypt, which symbolically then is what? Bondage. He's taken the children of Israel at the height of their glory, and his kingdom is going to be the pinnacle of the glory of this nation. From this moment on, it's downhill, and you might argue that downhill starts right here. Yes, the money's going to flow and things are going to happen after it. But this is arguably the point where Israel begins its descent. Symbolically, he has gone back and made an alliance with the people who put him in bondage. It makes him about like the children of Israel. Why did you bring us out here? At least we'd have cucumbers if we go back. That's for you, John. For your dad. I always enjoyed that. Went to Lee reading that passage and said, well, that's proof those people weren't in their right mind. But there's where they were at. And symbolically, that's exactly what he did. In making an alliance, what has he just said? I need them to sustain my kingdom. Oh, it's wise.
Yeah, I mean, this is Egypt. I want an alliance with you. It was northern border. I want to.
It's totally wise. It's totally wise. And from everything, essentially, from a political standpoint, Solomon was a master. He was extremely good. With all his concubines and wives, how many of them do you honestly think he even knew or met? Most of them were political alliances. He was constantly in the business of doing things. He was a Wall Street raider. Whereas his father was just a conqueror. But Solomon was great in this. Now, the one thing that's interesting about both David and Solomon is they had their weaknesses. And yet, God worked with them. And for us, from a spiritual standpoint, we may have our strengths, we may have our weaknesses, but understand that God can find the quality to work with. So, in our self-esteem world, having self-esteem, yeah, bear that in mind, that God wants to work with you on this. And some people have made some critical errors, but God will find a way to work with you. Of course, both of them showed moments of brilliance, didn't they, in their spiritual strife. And in this third chapter, we have that moment when Solomon sets himself really apart from most human beings. I cannot possibly imagine myself being that smart in the beginning to respond as he did. Give me anything? Ooh. And lights can go on as to all the things. And he could have asked for a lot of things here that would have been worthwhile. Peace on earth. Could have been chicken in every pot. Not even thinking necessarily about himself. But he asked for wisdom in doing what God wants. And that just, you can see the rise here of where the nation's going to go because of this. Now obviously, he received much greater than just that. But this is a remarkable thing. And we have then an example in the latter part of this chapter dealing with how his wisdom was exercised. And I think there's a great deal for us to gain from this. We have, of course, the two women who were morally bad people. Okay, they were harlots. And a lot of times we begin to toss off people in those circumstances as not having a great deal of value. And yet, Solomon didn't quite treat it that way. He looked at the tragedy of the whole situation. Of course, we recall that during the night, one of the women inadvertently killed a child. This happens all the time. It's a sad state of humans and their children, their offspring, that this sort of thing can happen. And of course, the one who's lost the baby wants to absolve herself of the guilt of it. This gets sort of in the line, I suppose, of where lying. Well, if you want to violate the law, are you willing to pay the price? You may have a very valid reason for it, but be willing to pay the price and accept your consequences, not so much with government, but accept your consequences with God over that. And this one who has committed this horrible thing, even though it was inadvertent, doesn't want to share the guilt of it. And the best resolution is, that's not my baby. That was your baby. And without DNA, and all of those factors that we would have now, you're left with a she said in this case. And Solomon comes to a resolution. Now, Solomon's decision in this is remarkable from several standpoints. And his initial reaction was pretty barbaric, wasn't it? His solution was, okay, here's a simple thing. You got two kids. You can have half and you can have half. Now, obviously, nobody's going to have a live baby at that point. And what do you think of that barbaric approach? What do you think his what do you think he thought would happen? Richard says exactly what happened, which of course was one said no. Let the other one take it. One agrees, didn't she? One agrees. Now you say, well, now Solomon, you made the proposition here. I agree with it. Go ahead and do it. But he didn't do it. Now, what do you think about his stance now? This is a tough situation, isn't it? Pardon? Yeah. Well, that's true. Remember that? That was the problem with Esther. King made a law and he couldn't rescind it. Truthfully, not a bad law. Generally, it's going to make leaders be really cautious before they pass law. But I can guarantee you that in Indiana, more than 3/4 of all bills that go into the legislature every year are to correct errors from the previous times. You couldn't make changes. You'd be real careful before you made a law. But yeah, good thing. But he did. That's his statement, isn't it? Here's the resolution to it. But he didn't uphold it, did he? The reason is, you can never compromise the sin. It was a sin to have murdered that baby, and he wasn't going to compromise it. So if somebody's talking about dividing something, whether it's a human or whether it's a church, that's a sin. And you can't compromise with that. You can't compromise. So he gives that baby, and everybody's amazed by this. And you and I read it, look at it, and I hate to say it, but we say, yeah, it was pretty smart, but then we go, that wasn't great. Really wasn't that great, was it? It sure was. To have the thought pattern come up with that is an indication of the divinity that God has granted to him in wisdom. And don't forget that he was wiser than all who lived before him. And the record says those who lived without him, without being God themselves. And so from that standpoint, it's highlighted there. But as we go on, and I'm going to skip into all these things that deal with his greatness, but there's something that we have to look at. When it comes time to be thinking about fulfilling the things that he wants to do, building his palace, building the temple, the dichotomy of Solomon comes out so clear, and we have this wonderful spiritual application of his wisdom, and yet when he went to prepare to sacrifice before there was a temple, where did he go? The high places. Isn't that something? It was the one thing the children of Israel were supposed to have taken care of, and they didn't. And we have this wonderful man who's in a peaceful kingdom, and he goes to worship God in the high places. Now, it may be indicative of one of those little road signs that is going to show that even though at times his heart was right, he didn't pay diligence to the minutia, if you want to say that, that God desires. God wanted those gone. You can't mix my religion with the religions of the world. And here, Solomon does that. And it was disastrous from a national standpoint. It was disastrous in a personal standpoint. Now, we all like to realize that he came back at a later time. And I believe that. When we read through both Ecclesiastes and look at the things that are in Proverbs, there's strong indication that at the end of his life, he understood that these are the little things along the way that led me in a wrong way. Most of the world that calls upon Christ celebrates Easter in a huge way. And if you really and truly talk to some of the people about what you do as a congregation, they honestly view you as anti-God. That is their honest approach, that you aren't doing what God wants. And so none of us like to think that. And so it's a whole lot easier. Let's just go to the high place. And Thomas, from a political standpoint, that was really good, wasn't it? Because it was all inclusive. One of the things that irritates me more than anything about our president is his statement that the Muslims are peace-loving people. It's only a few radicals. Politically, smart thing to say. True? No. And it gives a godly endorsement of the high places of Muslims. And so politically, see, I'm telling you, this guy's good. But we know his life and his greatness. And now it comes for his own passing of the torch, and it goes to Rehoboam. With Rehoboam, he's faced with a crisis at the outset. A lot of times in political changes of power, the predecessor has left problems that aren't easily dealt with. And a lot of times it comes back to haunt the successor. It may be that a predecessor has left a huge debt that didn't really appear on the books, and the successor is going to have to raise the taxes. In this particular case, when I mentioned that Solomon fulfills what God had said for Samuel to tell the people, what were the things that Samuel told the people the king would do? Do you remember? What was it that he said? What was it about the sons and daughters? He'd take them. Now, did Solomon do that? He put a conscription on the people to serve as laborers. He put heavy tax burdens on them. He built this massive temple, and we didn't even get into that. But it's a 4-story building, at the top of a 2,000-foot place where everything else, remember, you drop off of Jerusalem and you're sea level and below in real quick order. So 2,000 feet is really high. And he's put a 4-story building up here that's huge. Length and width and is glorious in all of its wealth that's there. And state of Indiana right now is in a state of almost rebellion over our property taxes. There are businesses that are honestly having to close because they can't pay the property tax. We are in a state where we're about like Solomon's situation, where they paid and paid, and not only paid, but had to go and do labor And the proposition comes, ease our burden, reduce the time of our service. You know, they didn't say we're not going to pay. And it wasn't the chance of the streets in the Vietnam era. I mean, we won't go, was the mantra. That's not all it said. They said, just, you know, ease it. And what did Rehoboam say? Rehoboam's not the master politician here, is he? He did not read that situation very well. He didn't get a sense of how upset the people were. To his credit, he did go to advisors, didn't he? He went to the advisors of his father, and they said what? They got a point. Listen to them. He rejected that, didn't he? And so often the case, when we hear something we don't want to hear, we go out and find people that are going to say what we want. And so he went out and found some others who were younger. Now, I don't know whether he already knew what they would say, or whether he instructed them on what to say, or whether they, being politicians, said, well, he didn't like their advice, so let's give the advice of the opposite side, and he'll elevate us. So I'm a cynical politician. You can see through these things. But in any case, they say, hey, you'll look weak if you bow down to them. And so he goes back, if you think my father was bad, wait till you see me. And they didn't wait around, did they? They went into a rebellion that did not end until 722 B.C. Yes. Absolutely. Now, that's a problem in the church. This event that happens here is indicative of human nature. When Paul wrote to Timothy, he said, what about itching ears? What was it? They will get their teachers who will say what they want. And so this very worldly thing that's presented here is not a map to political getting along. It's a map of doing what's right, regardless of what may be the outcome. And so often we can hear, well, they want to do this. And sometimes we should. But more likely, rather than doing what we should do, we'll find somebody that's going to agree with us. Go along. And these are dangers here. Now, when the rebellion happened, we have this man Jeroboam who rebelled against the father of Rehoboam, and Solomon took care of it in an almost Davidic type fashion. He exiled him. And that came back then to haunt his son, because Jeroboam comes back onto the scene and leads the 10 tribes into rebellion. Now, when we say the 10 tribes, well, of course, we've got then Judah and Benjamin that remain in the south. But is it an accurate statement to say that all 10 tribes left? What happened after the appointment of the priests in the northern kingdom? And then what happened when that occurred? Levites and some of all tribes left. And we have evidence then of that in the New Testament, and we have other than the tribe of Benjamin and Judah cited. So it's a verification of those things that they came about. Now, the most significant then event in a solid way that happens is that this kingdom is divided. And as we mentioned, it was not ended until the children of Israel were taken into captivity in 722 B.C. So, our time frame here is dealing, as we said, about 118 years, and it's dealing from approximately 967 down to about 849. Did I do my math right, Dave? I thought he was subtracting that. I don't do math, folks. I don't do it. Yeah, from eight. Okay. Yeah. It's attributed 967 or 965. Mm-hmm. And of course, I always find this interesting. God didn't really give too much of a care, did he, about the counting of those, pinpointing of those years. Now, he was very concerned about the days and months. He wasn't, and to a degree, years, but not numbering those years, because to him, 49 was the maximum number almost, wasn't it? But here this rebellion happens, and any time that there's a kingdom where God has wanted it to be won, he brought the nation in together. Now, yes, he divided them out into their territories so that they might have better opportunity of harmony. They might also be better spread throughout the land of promise that they could protect it. But he didn't envision this as part of their sanctuary. A divided thing. Oh, he knew it was going to happen, but that wasn't for the better. That's bad, but what's worse? What's worse in this? In this rebellion? And the two kingdoms? And that's an important factor that you bring up, because Jeroboam is now going to become not just the king of the northern nation, but he's also going to be that one individual that all the other kings are compared to. Now, Ahab was terrible, and he committed a whole lot of other things, but the worst thing that could be said about him was comparing to Jeroboam. And what is it that Jeroboam is charged by God with doing? He taught Israel to sing. And what was it that he taught them? Well, he said, "Hear, O Israel, are your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And he set forth a golden calf in Dan and in Bethel. And spiritually, we need to look at this event, because this is the real significant thing. And I don't mean to downplay Solomon and his wisdom and the ascension of Solomon and the descent after Rehoboam comes. But here it is from a spiritual standpoint. The first thing that he did was set up these two places of worship. Why? Why did he do that? What was his excuse? Well, yeah, he didn't want them to get back there, but what did he put forth to them as to why? It's too much for you to go all the way down there. Let's make our worship convenient. Let's not sacrifice time and effort to God. I mean, who is he to ask you to go three times a year from the Euphrates River? Well, really by this time only Dan. All the way down to Jerusalem. You can take your communion when you're going by from the ninth pole to the tenth pole. Right? Let's make this simple. And who can argue with that? No, he can't. He set the precedent, didn't he? See how little things start snowballing till we get to this point. Now, the second thing that Jeroboam does that's insidious. Hear, O Israel, are your God, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Now, it's been Richard brought it up. What happened at Sinai, Richard? We don't know what happened to this Moses. And so they made for themselves a golden calf. Now, this is in the Bible, isn't it? They would have been well familiar with this to a degree. To a degree. You see an ignorance. It's dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. That's totally it. One of the most forgotten names given to girls has been the name of Jezebel, who we're going to come in contact with. And of course, Jezebel was the wife of Ahab that becomes more, oddly enough, a symbol of evil in our thinking than Jeroboam, when Jeroboam is the real symbol of evil in all of this. And a lot of it, poor old Ahab gets the bad rap because of Jezebel. Now, I'm not excusing Ahab. He was an awful man. Terribly weak. Totally unfit to be a king. Other than he was vicious. But for generations and generations and centuries, people didn't name their daughters Jezebel until this generation. And I have twice now run into parents, not within the church, but religious people, believe it or not, who have named their children Jezebel. And I heard one say, well, it's in the Bible. And Thomas, that's exactly what Jeroboam was counting on. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, there was a golden calf, wasn't there? It's right in the Bible. And so we have Jeroboam teaching people, you make religion work to you, to your schedule, to your convenience, to your way of doing it. And secondly, he taught people ignorance is good. Isn't that scary? I think there's a spiritual application here that the greatest thing that we need to always protect is this word. When Satan wanted to attack the church, the first thing that the apostate church did at his bidding was to try to take away the word. And they fought hard to keep it out of the hands of people. I don't think in our times that he's really going to work that way. He's taking away the word from people who have it sitting all over their houses. You know, it's hard to find a home in America, or it was up until the last probably 20 years, to find a home in America that didn't have a Bible. Now, what was equally as hard is to find people who utilize that. And so through ignorance, Satan accomplishes what Jeroboam did here. Okay. Thoughts on that? Because to me, this is the real focal point of this. There's a definite line of demarcation that's happened here. And Jeroboam has walked away. And he's a pretty good politician,
isn't
he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Whether they were as evil or a little better, a whole lot worse.
And of course, in our history now, the northern kingdom is not going to have one king that God's going to declare as good. And they're not going to be abundant in the south either. And there's a clear spiritual lesson here for us too. That we are what we surround ourselves with. And that explains why those high places were so bad. And one of Solomon's great acts of worship was done there. And it just kind of comes down. Okay. One of those interesting events, and the reason this to me is of highly spiritual interest, is in this 13th chapter, after Jeroboam has set up these great idols, God sends a man from Judah, a prophet. What was that man's name? Not Joe Smith. Not Hezekiah. Not Moses. What spiritual application? Now we know what he did. Don't belittle this fellow. And it was great courage to go and stand before a king who has rebelled against and divided a nation. He's got a message from God that speaks unkindly of this man. Can you imagine going into Hitler and speaking against him? There were those who did it, didn't they? They died. They died. And that's really the expectation. How would you respond to this? Most of us got enough of brains to say, wait a minute. Hold on here. If I do this, how's he going to react to this? Well, he's going to kill me. Can't I send him an email? How about a carrier pigeon? Can I do something and this man overcomes this? There's something to be said about it. The spiritual. If God says to do something, eventually there's a good ending to it. Now, this man didn't have a good ending, did he? And yet, as long as time is going to go on, he's going to be remembered. As long as this earth exists with humans on it, he will be remembered. We don't know his name. And that becomes very important to us. Politicians got to have their names out there. There's an old adage that deals with politics. It says, I don't care what you say about me in the paper or the press. Just spell my name out. I've seen that happen. So many times. We got to have that name. Here, one of the great men of the Bible, in display of courage, his name's not shared with us. If we can adopt that, I don't have to be the great one thought of as the great speaker, the great teacher, the great elder, the great this or that. I just got to do what God says to do, and it's left. And he goes and he prophesies against Jeroboam and the thing that Jeroboam has set up. And he's also told that there's going to be an end to it. And makes one of those great prophecies that, of course, bears itself out in the years to come. You think God was really happy with what he did? Everything the prophet did? Nope. He did well up to a point. Isn't that enough to make it all right? He deviated, didn't he? Now, in many ways we'd say he didn't deviate in a willful way, did he? You know, he knew what he was supposed to do. Not go home the same way he came. Not eat, not drink, not do any of those things. Get home. What changed his opinion? What changed his mind? Yes. And that tells us we can do a lot of things right. And we can listen to another voice. Richard? In fact, there's almost a, his bones weren't burned by Josiah, were they? Do you remember why? Where did he have his bones placed? In the grave of the man of God. And this is an interesting thing because through the years, people knew that was that man of God's grave. And so when Josiah came in and Josiah's people came in and they destroyed all these things, they didn't burn that old liar's bones, did they? And it almost looks like he was rewarded. But understand this, and this may be part of why, sometimes, and we sing that song, when others seem to prosper day by day, though they turn, well, I don't know what it is, somebody else. Song. Yeah, year after year. But it doesn't work out in the end. And we can't think in the terms of this life.
I've never felt after God by with anything. I've always kind of felt like he was sort of washed up and that this young prophet was really wanted to be able to get hold of that.
Oh, I don't think so at all. And the interesting thing is, though, God utilizes some of those situations. He really got a message from God, didn't he? And to his credit, he gave it. He gave it. And the recipient sure didn't want to hear it, did he? And the message for us is, when God gives us an instruction, go ahead and do it all. Second Timothy, or First Timothy, second chapter tells us something about Eve, that she was deceived. And that, you know, that was her claim from the outset. And the thing about deception is that we have to understand that even though intellectually she knew that what she was doing was wrong, right? Intellectually, she said what would happen if she did this. But Satan had convinced her that doing wrong was right. And isn't that exactly what this old prophet did? And so there's a consistency. God shows us that's what Satan did here the first time that Satan approached man. It's what Satan did here. And so we can accept then that Satan is going to do the same thing. He's going to give us a religious alternative to the instructions that God has given to see if we're going to take it. Now, jumping past Ahab. He's such a colorful character, we don't need to be. Although his weaknesses are so great, they're beautiful to look at. But the one thing that in all this chaos, God had established when the children of Israel came in, that when they needed a judge, he was there. And when that system broke down, he relented to the kingship with the advice, they're not rejecting you, Samuel, they're rejecting me. They had a king, they just didn't know it. But God is not going to leave his people in a wilderness. And so what is his solution then to help the people get back to the right? That's in the latter part of this book where we find a new type of leader in the land. Who was that? Elijah the prophet. Now, there have been prophets before, but now we have a prophet that comes in a different fashion. And the message that we get from this is that God is going to always put the mechanism in place so that when we're in a spiritual wasteland, that He has a way. Now, it is an interesting thing that Elijah sometimes, because of his spiritual work, had to go into the wasteland to hide, didn't he? But did that mean that the word was gone? Well, no. It is an interesting thing about Elijah because he's so human. In the great moment when he should have been king of the world. Looky here. I have been the messenger that defeated or should have defeated forever any followers of Baal. That should have been eliminated. And yet, with apparently a massive number of them killed, Jezebel revives it and goes out after Elijah. And he runs away from the circumstances that he should not have run away from, because again, we come back to this, God was his protection and he sought his own means of running away from God. But God makes a statement that's interesting about Israel and his own prophets. Do you recall what that was in the number? Who have not bowed a knee. And this is in the godless area. What we, in our own mindset, say, well, that's the godless area. Spiritually, what that tells us, we think, and probably rightly so, that we are growing smaller and smaller, and we can be like Elijah and just run away from him. Try to hide. What God says is open up your eyes. There were others around you all along. And yes, brethren, the message you can take back to your congregation and to your families is yes, we are going to be continually growing smaller, most likely. You don't think the borders are closing in on us by our own government, and you're sadly mistaken. I've pointed out to so many people that in the first Gulf War, Saudi Arabia, our ally, made a directive to the United States Department of State that our soldiers not be allowed to bring in the Bible to their land. And you know what? The Department of Defense sent out that order to our soldiers. They were not allowed to do that. You don't think the fences are coming in on us? We need to open up our eyes on that. And that's one of those reasons we might want to be exercising our political rights of voting. But even as those fences come in, never lose sight of what Elijah lost sight of. Now, what was God's resolution to Elijah's dilemma? How did he propose that Elijah get past this situation? In essence, what did he say, though? Get to work. Get back to work. You've got things to do. And if you can't see what you need to do, here's what it is. You go appoint some kings and you appoint somebody to take your place. Now, I've already told you there's thousands of them out there. And here's one way to do. In other words, there's still work to do. It's easy for us to get lost in what we're losing and not look at what's yet ahead. And that, in a quick nutshell, is 1 Kings, without really looking at the individual accomplishments and failures of some of these kings. Some of them, yes, had moments of greatness. Some of them didn't. Obviously, the thing that is God holds as a standard of greatness is how they reacted to His Word. Were they great in the terms of financial success for the nation? No. In fact, through this whole period of time, the violence of the divorce of these two peoples, became two peoples, two nations, they kept declining, declining, declining. And one might really argue that this nation has never financially, politically recovered. Ever. They gained something in June of 1967. But they don't have the wealth of Solomon. They don't have the political security that David established. And so, this division that, yeah, Rehoboam had a part in. Jeroboam had a part in. One could easily argue that probably Jeroboam, if Rehoboam had relented, would have found something else. But it usually takes two to tango, and it takes two to stop tangoing. And these parties were at fault for it.
Then shall stand up in his estate a razor of pasture to the glory of the king. But within 3 days he shall be destroyed, neither any of them.
And they just left, didn't they?
All the
Read my lips. Well, it's one of those great things in American politics, isn't it? Lost a kingdom. Well, let's go ahead and close in prayer. If you've got other thoughts, we've got a few minutes here to look at that. Joshua, could you close us in prayer?